Homer's Iliad tells the story about Achilles, set against the history of the Greeks' war against Troy. Homer's Odyssey tells the story of Odysseus' harrowing return home after the Greek victory at Troy. They are great epics about great men. Welcome to Wyoming Catholic College's After Dinner Scholar Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, Director of Distance Learning. Virgil the Roman added a new element to the Greek model of epic. The Aeneid, while being the story about a great man, goes beyond the travails of Aeneas to Virgil's primary subject, the founding of Rome with its universal application. That is, Virgil added a public, even a cosmic, element to his epic. Centuries later, in the 1600s, when we come to John Milton's Paradise Lost, the subject of today's podcast, we find the public and cosmic element encompassing the entire human race. Milton's epic spans all of history, from the fall of Satan and his angels, to the creation of Adam and Eve, to the fall of man, to the cross of Christ, to the second coming. In a preface to Paradise Lost, Milton scholar C.S. Lewis wrote, "Paradise Lost records a real, irreversible, unrepeatable process of the history of the universe. And even for those who do not believe this, it embodies the great change in every individual soul from happy dependence to miserable self-assertion, and thence either, as in Satan, to final isolation, or as in Adam, to reconcilement and a different happiness." Wyoming Catholic College President Dr. Glenn Arbery has taught Paradise Lost for many years, and he's currently working through the poem with our juniors. Dr. Arbery joins us in this podcast. Dr. Arbery, welcome. Let me begin by a fairly straightforward question. Milton was kind of a latter-day Puritan, and is this the Puritan epic, the Protestant epic, where Dante was kind of a Catholic epic and Virgil was the Roman epic and so on?
I think it's easy to see that this epic is very different from Dante's epic. It's really more classical in form than Dante's is, oddly, and you would think that Milton, being a Puritan, would sort of move away from the traditional forms, but he's more adamant about making this an epic in the vein of Homer and Virgil than Dante seemed to be. Dante was more inventive in his form, but Milton is certainly in the epic tradition in a big way. His Protestantism comes out, I think, in the way he depicts the Father and the Son, and I think it comes out in various ways later in the poem when you see him siding with the Puritans against kingship, particularly in the account that Michael gives of the biblical story to Adam at the end of the poem. Milton is very wary of kingship. He makes a big point of saying that God gave man dominion over the beasts of the field and the birds of the air and so on, but not over his fellow man. So I think the experiment of the Commonwealth in England under Oliver Cromwell was very much to Milton's taste, you know, a more republican form. And so I think at various points in the poem, you see evidence of that.
At the beginning of the poem, he says he wants to assert eternal providence and justify the ways of God to men. What does he mean by that? What's the story of the poem?
Well, the big picture of the poem is the fall of man, obviously, you know, Paradise Lost. But Milton contextualizes it by putting the fall of man into the larger story of the fall of the angels, which actually precede creation itself, you know, in Milton's depiction of it. The issue is that God foreknows the fall, even when Satan is coming up toward earth to tempt Adam and Eve. God is already foreknowing that Adam and Eve will fall. He calls him ingrate before Satan ever gets there to tempt him. So how is it that God could create man, foreknow his fall, and still be justified in allowing all this to come to be? Now, I think the answer has to do with freedom, but that's kind of another question. But the whole story of the poem involves Satan coming to this new creation and bringing about the fall of man to join him and the other fallen angels in hell. And why God allows this and what comes from it, which is obviously the incarnation and eventually the salvation of man. But there's still lots of questions there that are, you know, that Milton doesn't hesitate to raise.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that, the poem, of course, begins not in paradise, but in hell,
right?
With Satan, his fallen angels having been cast out of heaven, lying in hideous ruin and combustion down to bottomless perdition, there to dwell in adamantine chains and penal fire. And yet Satan doesn't despair. And in fact, he rallies his troops. Tell us about Milton's understanding of Satan, the fallen angels, and the nature of evil.
Well, it's funny to say that Satan doesn't despair because he doesn't seem to. He wakes up. He sort of looks around hell, reassesses his surroundings, and then rouses the other fallen angels to join him in their next phase of their war against God. It's a foregone conclusion that they're going to lose, especially if they do anything by force, because they've just experienced the full wrath of God in driving them out of heaven. But Their intention now is to do this by guile rather than by force. So that's what they set about to do. But underlying it all is this recognition that they will never have the beatitude that they had before. Satan's looks are changed, but what remains is this kind of what looks like a very heroic demeanor. He's defiant. He refuses to be defeated. Now, the more you read the poem, the more you recognize that Milton's Satan is doing everything for himself. The kind of glory he can get even from the fallen angels is more satisfying to him than being subservient in heaven. So it's a curious figure. He's struck the romantics as being the hero of the poem. He's obviously got lots of things to draw the reader in. He's more like us, you know, in some ways, in our original condition, as you know, has fallen. So it's in a one sense the story of Satan, you know, that you're tracing through the poem, and then another sense it's God's answer to Satan that's also accompanying that story all the way through. And of course, Adam and Eve are at the center of that story.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, you know, certainly Satan is a compelling figure. And I mean, some have written the most compelling in the poem.
Right.
On the one hand, he sort of seems like an epic hero, kind of like Achilles.
Yeah.
And then he's sort of like a tragic hero that's the hubris and the, you know, sort of like one of the Greek tragic. Or, you know, is he one of those things, or is he in the final analysis kind of a fool, kind of an object of ridicule?
By the end of the poem, he's obviously an object of ridicule. He comes back to hell after having successfully tempted Adam and Eve, and instead of the applause that he expects, it's this universal hiss, because all of the other fallen angels have been turned into serpents, as has he. Mm-hmm. And then when he tries to enjoy the fruit of his victory over them, all of the devils go up these trees and bite apples that turn into ashes in their mouth. And it becomes a matter of ridicule from heaven's perspective. On the other hand, the way that Satan is presented through the poem is always in terms of courage. And I think that's probably the one thing that makes him admirable as a figure in the poem, is that even when he's confronted by angels who will drive him out of the Garden of Eden, for example, he's always courageous in his bearing toward them. So you can't deny him that. You know, you can't deny him certain kinds of virtues, but they don't really ever make him a tragic hero because he's already fallen before it ever began.
Mm-hmm.
You don't really see him as the epic hero because he doesn't bring about anything good. What he brings about is, you know, is a kind of universal evil. So he's paradoxical, you know, and I think that's part of the fascination of the figure in the poem.
Well, and also someone I was reading that along as you go through it, and you see it in Satan, and you also see it in Adam and Eve. After they fall, their minds start producing nonsense.
Right. Yeah. Nonsense like ours.
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, they start thinking the way we think.
Well, Satan makes an argument that right. he is self-created.
Right. Yeah, he says to Abdiel and the other angels, you know, I don't remember being created. I came into being all my own, as far as I know. So it's a, and this, you know, this also is something particularly modern that I think Milton's pointing to. This sense that we are self-made, you know, that this becomes a dominant kind of modern trait that you can trace from maybe the some of the humanists of the Renaissance, certainly not all of them, but you know, there's a real strain of that in Milton.
Now, I think one of the most amazing parts of the poem is Milton's description of Adam and Eve and Eden before the fall.
It's gorgeous. Yeah.
Could you
well,
tell us about that?
And it's gorgeous and it's controversial. Mm-hmm. If you're a Renaissance humanist and you see this depiction of Adam and Eve, I think you see the glory of man, you know, the glory of unfallen man. Adam is, you know, this heroic figure with a frame that's got to be kind of Herculean or something. He's the prototype of all heroes. He's also formed for contemplation. So you see a kind of majesty of intellect in him as well as a physical form. Eve is more controversially depicted because she is created for Adam. I think the way that Milton puts it, he for God only, she for God in him. So she has a kind of secondary character, though she's obviously the most beautiful. The way that her hair is described is wanton. There's a lot of interesting speculation about Milton's language and how you can see certain words in a pre-fallen way that then change their meanings after the fall, wanton being one of those in describing the way her hair falls. But they're a splendid pair, and even Satan, when he first sees them, is just taken aback, especially when he sees Eve just before he tempts her. There's that famous line where Satan stands there stupidly good, sort of bereft of his own evil because he's so taken with their beauty.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Satan tempts them, they eat the apple, and what are the results?
Well, the immediate result is that Eve feels this kind of drunken exaltation when she eats it and thinks that she's soaring up into realms of thought that she's never been able to reach before. She debates whether she'll even offer the apple to Adam because maybe she'll be superior to him if she has it and he doesn't. But then she starts thinking, yes, but what if I die and he doesn't? And so anyway, you know, you see them reasoning this way. The immediate result after Adam sort of nobly eats the apple because he doesn't want to live without her is that they begin to have lustful feelings that they never had before. They were the pure couple, which is not to say that they were without sex. I mean, this is something that that Milton makes a big deal of.
Right, yeah. Right?
You know, hail wedded love, he says. But what happens after the fall is that turns sour, you know, it turns ugly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we even see it in Scripture where right. God said, did you eat the apple? And right. Adam says, well, actually, the woman you gave me.
That's right. It's her fault.
Yeah, do anything
and
you want.
She blames the serpent.
Right. Do anything you want to the girl. Just leave me alone. even as you already alluded to, even as Satan travels to Eden, there's a conversation in heaven about yeah. redemption.
Yeah. And, so God foresees what's going to happen. The Father and the Son are depicted in ways that C.S. Lewis finds uncomfortable, and I think most readers do. God is more Zeus-like than he is in Dante, you know, where he's not visible in kind of human terms. But in any case, God sees Satan going toward Eden. He foreknows what will happen. And in that conversation, he asks, who will go and save man? You know, there are two things. Somebody has to take the punishment for the crime. It has to be satisfied. But then there also has to be some restoration so that man will be even greater than he was before. And the Son takes those tasks on. And I think takes them on, we have to say, freely. If he doesn't take them on freely, then there's no merit in it. And this is a big issue in the whole way that Milton understands freedom.
And that kind of leads to the last question I wanted to ask you. Is this a good book to read during Lent? And if so, how do listeners get a handle on this book?
Well, I think it's possibly good to read during Lent, just because it makes you so aware of your sinfulness and your capacity to fall. If Adam and Eve could fall, you know, and they were created sufficient to have stood, though free to fall, as Milton puts it, or as God says to the Son, then, you know, how do we stand with this? So I think it does point to our own weakness, but it also is a story about salvation. So, you know, what happens in the course of the Son's willingness to become man and suffer for our sake. There are some things I think Catholics will stumble over in the course of the poem, but on the other hand, it is a majestic work. And I forget who exactly said it, maybe Samuel Johnson, maybe C.S. Lewis, but it's not the greatest epic only because it's not the first. It's a very great poem, and I think anybody would benefit from reading it.
Good. All right, well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim.
In Paradise Lost, Satan, Hell, Heaven, Adam, Eve, Freedom, Choice, the Fall, the Messiah are not what we would expect. The poet takes us beyond our imaginations in a way that stretches and grows his readers. Thank you for listening, and if you're enjoying these podcasts, why not subscribe today and put out the good word to your family and friends? For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.